59. An honor. Above the final void I hang, friends behind, friends before. The feast I must drink clings to their faces, and the words I must speak spark in my mind. The old oaths will be spoken anew. Dated Beta Bannon, 1173. 45 seconds pre-death. Subject, a light-eyed child of 5 years. Diction improved remarkably when giving sample. Kaladin glared at the three glowing topaz spheres on the ground in front of him. The barrack was dark, empty save for Teft and himself. Lopin leaned in the sunlit doorway, watching with a casual air. Outside, Rock called out commands to the other bridgemen. Kaladin had them working on battle formations. Nothing overt. It would be construed as practice for bridge carrying, but he was actually training them to obey orders and rearrange themselves efficiently. The three little spheres, only chips, lit the stone ground around themselves in little tan rings. Kaladin focused on them, holding his breath, willing the light into him. Nothing happened. He tried harder, staring into their depths. Nothing happened. He picked one up, cupping it in his palm, raising it so that he could see the light and nothing else. He could pick out the details of the storm, the shifting, spinning vortex of light. He commanded it, willed it, begged it. Nothing happened. He groaned, lying back on the rock, staring at the ceiling.
"Maybe you don't want it badly enough," Teft said.
"I want it as badly as I know how. It won't budge, Teft."
Teft grunted and picked up one of the spheres.
"Maybe we're wrong about me," Kaladin said.
It seemed poetically appropriate that the moment he accepted this strange, frightening part of himself, he couldn't make it work.
"It could have been a trick of the sunlight."
"A trick of the sunlight," Teft said flatly. "Sticking a bag to the barrel was a trick of the light."
"All right, then maybe it was some odd fluke, something that happened just that once."
"And when you were wounded," Teft said, "and whenever on a bridge run you needed an extra burst of strength or endurance."
Kaladin let out a frustrated sigh and tapped his head back lightly against the rock floor a few times.
"Well, if I'm one of these radiants you keep talking about, why can't I do anything?"
"I figure," the grizzled old bridgeman said, rolling the sphere in his fingers, "that you're like a baby, making his legs work. At first it just kind of happens. Slowly he figures how to make them move on purpose. You just need practice."
"I've spent a week staring at spheres, Teft. How much practice can it take?"
"Well, more than you've had, obviously."
Kaladin rolled his eyes and sat back up.
"Why am I listening to you? You've admitted that you don't know any more than I do."
"I don't know anything about using the stormlight," Teft said, scowling. "But I know what should happen."
"According to stories that contradict one another, you've told me that the Radiants could fly and walk on walls."
Teft nodded.
"They sure could. And make stone melt by looking at it. And move great distances in a single heartbeat. And command the sunlight.
And why," Kaladin said, "would they need to both walk on walls and fly? If they can fly, why would they bother running up walls?"
Teft said nothing.
"And why bother with either one," Kaladin added, "if they can just move great distances in a heartbeat?"
"I'm not sure," Teft admitted.
"We can't trust the stories or legends," Kaladin said.
He glanced at Syl, who had landed beside one of the spheres, staring at it with childlike interest.
"Who knows what is true and what has been fabricated? The only thing we know for certain is this."
He plucked up one of the spheres and held it up in two fingers. "The Radiant sitting in this room is very, very tired of the color brown." Teft grunted.
"You're not a Radiant, lad."
"Weren't we just talking about—"
"Oh, you can infuse," Teft said. "You can drink in the stormlight and command it. But being a Radiant was more than that. It was their way of life, the things they did, the immortal words.
The what?
Teft rolled his sphere between his fingers again, holding it up and staring into its depths.
Life before death, strength before weakness, journey before destination. That was their motto, and was the first ideal of the immortal words. There were four others.
Kaladin raised an eyebrow.
Which were?
I don't actually know, Teft said. But the immortal words, these ideals, guided everything they did. The four later ideals were said to be different for every order of Radiance. But the first ideal was the same for each of the ten. Life before death, strength before weakness, journey before destination.
He hesitated.
Or so I was told.
Yes, well, that seems a little obvious to me, Kaladin said. Life comes before death, just like day comes before night, or one comes before two. Obvious.
You're not taking this seriously. Maybe that's why the Stormlight refuses you.
Kaladin stood and stretched.
I'm sorry, Teft. I'm just tired.
Life before death, Teft said, wagging a finger at Kaladin. The Radiant seeks to defend life, always. He never kills unnecessarily, and never risks his own life for frivolous reasons. Living is harder than dying. The Radiant's duty is to live. Strength before weakness. All men are weak at some time in their lives. The Radiant protects those who are weak, and uses his strength for others. Strength does not make one capable of rule. It makes one capable of service.
Teft picked up the spheres, putting them in his pouch. He held the last one for a second, then tucked it away too.
Journey before destination. There are always several ways to achieve a goal. Failure is preferable to winning through unjust means. Protecting 10 innocents is not worth killing one. In the end, all men die. How you lived will be far more important to the Almighty than what you accomplished.
The Almighty? So the knights were tied to religion?
Isn't everything? There was some old king who came up with all this. Had his wife write it in a book or something. My mother read it. The Radiance based the ideals on what was written there.
Kaladin shrugged, moving over to begin sorting through the pile of Bridgman's leather vests. Ostensibly, he and Teft were here checking those over for tears or broken straps. After a few moments, Teft joined him.
Do you actually believe that?
Kaladin asked, lifting up a vest, tugging on its straps. That anyone would follow those vows? Particularly a bunch of light eyes?
They weren't just light eyes. They were Radiants.
They were people, Kaladin said. Men in power always pretend things like virtue or divine guidance, some kind of mandate to protect the rest of us. If we believe that the Almighty put them where they are, it's easier for us to swallow what they do to us.
Teft turned a vest over. It was beginning to tear beneath the left shoulder pad.
I never used to believe. And then I saw you infusing light and I began to wonder.
Stories and legends, Teft, Kaladin said. We want to believe that there were better men once. That makes us think it could be that way again. But people don't change. They are corrupt now. They were corrupt then.
Maybe, Teft said. My parents believed in all of it. The immortal words, the ideals, the Knights Radiant, the Almighty. Even old Voronism. In fact, especially old Voronism.
That led to the hierocracy. The devotaries and the Ardents shouldn't hold land or property. It's too dangerous.
Teft snorted.
Why? You think they'd be worse at being in charge than the Light Eyes?
Well, you've probably got a point there.
Kaladin frowned.
He'd spent so long assuming the Almighty had abandoned him, or even cursed him, that it was difficult to accept that maybe, as Syl had said, he'd instead been blessed. Yes, he'd been preserved, and he supposed he should be grateful for that. But what could be worse than being granted great power, yet still being too weak to save those he loved? Further speculation was interrupted as Lopin stood up straight in the doorway, gesturing covertly to Kaladin and Teft. Fortunately, there wasn't anything to hide anymore. In fact, there hadn't ever been anything to hide, other than Kaladin sitting on the floor and staring at the spheres like an idiot. He set aside the vest and walked to the entrance. Hashal's palanquin was being carried directly toward Kaladin's barrack, her tall, oft-silent husband walking alongside. The sash at his neck was violet, as was the embroidery on the cuffs of his short, vest-like jacket. Gaz still hadn't reappeared. It had been a week now, and no sign of him. Hashal and her husband, along with their light-eyed attendants, did what he'd once done, and they rebuffed any questions about the bridge sergeant.
"Storm it," Teft said, stepping up beside Kaladin. "Those two make my skin itch. Same way it does when I know someone's got a knife and is standing behind me."
Rock had the bridgemen lined up and waiting quietly as if for inspection. Kaladin walked out to join them, Teft and Lopin following behind. The bearers set the palanquin down in front of Kaladin. Open-sided with only a small canopy on the top, it was little more than an armchair on a platform. Many of the light-eyed women used them in the war camps. Kaladin reluctantly gave Hashal a proper bow, prompting the other bridgemen to do so as well. Now was not the time to be beaten for insubordination.
"You have such a well-trained band, bridge leader," she said, idly scratching her cheek with a ruby-red nail, her elbow on her armrest. "So efficient at bridge runs."
"Thank you, Brightness Hashal," Kaladin said, trying, but failing, to keep the stiffness and hostility from his voice. "May I ask, Gaz hasn't been seen for some days now. Is he well?"
"No."
Kaladin waited for further reply, but she didn't give one.
"My husband has made a decision. Your men are so good at bridge runs that you are a model to the other crews. As such, you will be on bridge duty every day from now on."
Kaladin felt a chill.
"And scavenging duty?"
"Oh, there will still be time for that. You need to take torches down anyway, and plateau runs never happen at night. So your men will sleep during the day, always on call, and will work the chasms at night. A much better use of your time."
"Every bridge run," Kaladin said. "You're going to make us go on every one?"
"Yes," she said idly, tapping for her bearers to raise her. "Your team is just too good. It must be used. You'll start full-time bridge duty tomorrow. Consider it an honor."
Kaladin inhaled sharply to keep himself from saying what he thought of her honor. He couldn't bring himself to bow as she retreated, but she didn't seem to care. Rock and the men started muttering. Every bridge run. She'd just doubled the rate at which they'd be killed. Kaladin's team wouldn't last another few weeks. They were already so low on members that losing one or two men on an assault would cause them to flounder. The Parshendi would focus on them then, cutting them down.
"Kallax's breath," Teft said. "She'll see us dead."
"It's not fair," Lopin added.
"We're bridgemen," Kaladin said, looking at them. "What made you think that any kind of fairness applied to us?"
"She hasn't killed us fast enough for Sadeas," Moash said. "You know that soldiers have been beaten for coming to look for you, to see the man who survived the high storm? He hasn't forgotten about you, Kaladin."
Teft was still swearing. He pulled Kaladin aside, Lopin following, but the others remained talking among themselves.
"Damnation," Teft said softly. "They like to pretend to be even-handed with the bridge crews. Makes them seem fair. Looks like they gave up on that. bastards.
What do we do, Gonshow? Lopin asked.
We go to the chasms, Kaladin said. Just like we're scheduled to. Then we make sure we get some extra sleep tonight, as we're apparently going to be staying up all night tomorrow.
The men will hate going into the chasms at night, lad, Teft said.
I know.
But we're not ready for what we need to do, Teft said, looking to make sure nobody could hear.
It was only him, Kaladin, and Lopin.
It will be another few weeks, at least.
I know.
We won't last another few weeks, Teft said. With Sadeus and Colin working together, runs happen nearly every day. Just one bad run, one time with the Parshendi drawing bead on us, and it will all be over. We'll be wiped out.
I know, Kaladin said, frustrated, taking a deep breath and forming fists to keep himself from exploding.
Gonshow, Lopin said.
What? Kaladin snapped.
It's happening again.
Kaladin froze, then looked down at his arms. Sure enough, he caught a hint of luminescent smoke rising from his skin. It was extremely faint. He didn't have many gemstones near him, but it was there. The wisps faded quickly. Hopefully the other bridgemen hadn't seen.
Damnation. What did I do?
I don't know, Teft said. Is it because you were angry at Hashal?
I was angry before.
You breathed it in,
Syl said eagerly, whipping around him in the air a ribbon of light.
What?
I saw it.
She twisted herself around.
You were mad, you drew in a breath, and the light? It came too.
Kaladin glanced at Teft, but of course the older bridgeman hadn't heard.
Gather the men, Kaladin said. We're going down to our chasm duty.
And what about what has happened?
Teft said.
Kaladin, we can't go on that many bridge runs. We'll be cut to pieces.
I'm doing something about it today.
Gather the men.
Syl, I need something from you.
What?
She landed in front of him and formed into a young woman.
Go find us a place where some Parshendi corpses have fallen.
I thought you were going to do spear practice today.
That's what the men will be doing, Kaladin said.
I'll get them organized first. After that, I have a different task.
Kaladin clapped a quick signal and the bridgemen made a decent arrowhead formation. They carried the spears they'd stashed in the chasm, secured in a large sack filled with stones and stuck in a crevice. He clapped his hands again and they rearranged into a double-line wall formation. He clapped again and they formed into a ring with one man standing behind every two as a quick step in reserve. The walls of the chasm dripped with water, and the bridgemen splashed through puddles.
They were good. Better than they had any right to be.
Better, for their level of training, than any team he'd worked with. But Teft was right. They still wouldn't last long in a fight. A few more weeks and he'd have them practiced enough with thrusts and shielding one another that they'd begin to be dangerous. Until then, they were just bridgemen who could move in fancy patterns. They needed more time. Kaladin had to buy them some.
Teft,
Kaladin said,
take over.
The older bridgeman gave one of those cross-armed salutes.
Syl, Kaladin said to the Spren,
let's go see those bodies.
They're close. Come on.
She zipped off down the chasm, a glowing ribbon. Kaladin started after her.
Sir,
Teft called. Kaladin hesitated. When had Teft started calling him sir? Odd how right that felt.
Yes? You want an escort?
Teft stood at the head of the gathered bridgemen, who were looking more and more like soldiers, with their leather vests and spears held in practiced grips. Kaladin shook his head.
I'll be fine.
Chasm fiends.
The light eyes have killed any who prowl this close to our side. Besides, if I did run into one, what difference would two or three extra men make?
Teft grimaced behind his short, graying beard, but offered no further objection. Kaladin continued to follow Syl. In his pouch, he carried the rest of the spheres they'd discovered on bodies while scavenging.
They made a habit of keeping some of each discovery and sticking them to bridges, and with Syl helping at scavenging, they now found more than they used to. He had a small fortune in his pouch. That stormlight, he hoped, would serve him well today. He got out a sapphire mark for light, avoiding pools of water floating with bones. A skull bobbed leisurely in one, wavy green moss growing across the scalp like hair, lifespren bobbing above. Perhaps it should have felt eerie to walk through these darkened slots alone, but they didn't bother Kaladin. This was a sacred place, the sarcophagus of the lowly, the burial cavern of bridgemen and spearmen who died upon light-eyed edicts, spilling blood down the sides of these ragged walls. This place wasn't eerie, it was holy. He was actually glad to be alone with his silence and the bobbing remains of those who had died. These men hadn't cared about the squabbles of those born with lighter eyes than they. These men had cared about their families, or, at the very least, their sphere pouches. How many of them were trapped in this foreign land? These endless plateaus, too poor to escape back to Alethkar. Hundreds died each week, winning gems for men who were already rich, winning vengeance for a king long dead. Kaladin passed another skull, missing its lower jaw, the crown split by an axe's blow. The bones seemed to watch him, curious, the blue stormlight in his hand giving a haunted cast to the uneven ground and walls. The Devotaries taught that when men died, the most valiant among them, the ones who fulfilled their callings best, would rise to help reclaim heaven. Each man would do as he had done in life, spearmen to fight, farmers to work spiritual farms, light eyes to lead. The Ardens were careful to point out that excellence in any calling would bring power. A farmer would be able to wave his hand and create great fields of spiritual crops. A spearman would be a great warrior, able to cause thunder with his shield and lightning with his spear. But what of the bridgemen? Would the Almighty demand that all of these fallen rise and continue their drudgery? Would Dunny and the others run bridges in the afterlife? No Ardens came to them to test their abilities or grant them elevations. Perhaps the bridgemen wouldn't be needed in the war for heaven. Only the very most skilled went there anyway. Others would simply slumber until the Tranquiline Halls were reclaimed. So do I believe again now? He climbed over a boulder wedged in the chasm. Just like that? He wasn't sure, but it didn't matter. He would do the best he could for his bridgemen. If there was a calling in that, so be it. Of course, if he did escape with his team, Sadeus would replace them with others who would die in their stead. I have to worry about what I can do, he told himself. Those other bridgemen aren't my responsibility. Teft talked about the Radiance, about ideals and stories. Why couldn't men actually be like that? Why did they have to rely on dreams and fabrications for inspiration? If you flee, you leave all the other bridgemen to be slaughtered, a voice whispered within him. There has to be something you can do for them. No, he fought back. If I worry about that, I won't be able to save Bridge Four. If I find a way out, we're going. If you leave, the voice seemed to say, then who will fight for them? Nobody cares. Nobody. What was it his father had said all those years ago? He did what he felt was right because someone had to start. Someone had to take the first step. Kaladin's hand felt warm. He stopped in the chasm, closing his eyes. You couldn't feel any heat from a sphere, usually, but the one in his hand seemed warm. And then, feeling completely natural about it, Kaladin breathed in deeply. The sphere grew cold, and a wave of heat shot up his arm. He opened his eyes. The sphere in his hand was done, and his fingers were crispy with frost. Light rose from him like smoke from a fire. White. Pure. He raised a hand and felt alive with energy. He had no need to breathe, In fact, he held the breath in, trapping the stormlight. Syl zipped back down the corridor toward him. She twisted around him, then came to rest in the air, taking the form of a woman.
You did it. What happened?
Kaladin shook his head, holding his breath. Something was surging within him, like a storm, raging inside his veins, a tempest sweeping about inside his chest cavity. It made him want to run, jump, yell. It almost made him want to burst. He felt as if he could walk on air, or walls. Yes, he thought. He broke into a run, leaping at the side of the chasm. He hit feet first, then bounced off and slammed back into the ground. He was so stunned that he cried out, and he felt the storm within him dampen as breath escaped. He lay on his back as stormlight rose from him more quickly now that he was breathing. He lay there as the last bit of it burned away. Syl landed on his chest.
Kaladin? What was that?
Me being an idiot, he replied, sitting up and feeling an ache in his back and a sharp pain in his elbow where he'd hit the ground. Teft said that the Radiants were able to walk on walls, and I felt so alive. Syl walked on air, stepping as if down a set of stairs.
I don't think you're ready for that yet. Don't be so risky. If you die, I go stupid again, you know.
I'll try to keep that in mind, Kaladin said, climbing to his feet. Maybe I'll remove dying from my list of tasks to do this week. She snorted, zipping into the air, becoming a ribbon again.
Come on, hurry up.
She shot off down the chasm. Kaladin collected the dun sphere, then dug into the pouch for another one to provide light. Had he drained them all? No. The others still glowed strongly. He selected a ruby mark, then hurried after Syl. She led him to a narrow chasm that contained a small group of fresh Parshendi corpses.
This is morbid, Kaladin,
Syl noted, standing above the bodies. I know. Do you know where Lopin went?
I sent him scavenging nearby, fetching the things you asked him for.
Bring him, please. Syl sighed, but zipped away. She always got testy when he made her appear to someone other than him. Kaladin knelt down. Parshendi all looked so similar. That same square face, those blocky, almost rock-like features. Some had the beards with bits of gemstone tied in them. Those glowed, but not brightly. Cut gemstones held stormlight better. Why was that? Rumors in camp claimed that the Parshendi took the wounded humans away and ate them. Rumors also said they left their dead, not caring for the fallen, never building them proper pyres. But that last part was false. They did care about their dead. They all seemed to have the same sensibility that Shen did. He threw a fit every time one of the bridgemen so much as touched a Parshendi corpse. I'd better be right about this, Kaladin thought grimly, slipping a knife off one of the Parshendi bodies. It was beautifully ornamented and forged, the steel lined with glyphs Kaladin didn't recognize. He began to cut at the strange breastplate armor that grew from the corpse's chest. Kaladin quickly determined that Parshendi physiology was very different from human physiology. Small blue ligaments held the breastplate to the skin underneath. It was attached all the way across. He continued working. There wasn't much blood. It had pooled at the corpse's back or leaked away. His knife wasn't a surgeon's tool, but it did the job just fine. By the time Syl returned with Lopin, Kaladin had gotten the breastplate free and had moved on to the carapace helm. It was harder to remove. It had grown into the skull in places, and he had to saw with the serrated section of the blade.
Oh, Goncho, Lopin said, a sack slung over his shoulder. You don't like them at all, do you?
Kaladin stood, wiping his hands on the Parshendi man's skirt. Did you find what I asked for?
Sure did,
Lopin said, letting down the sack and digging into it. He pulled out an armored leather vest and cap, the type that spearmen used. Then he took out some thin leather straps and a medium-sized wooden spearman's shield. Finally came a series of deep red bones. Parshendi bones. At the very bottom of the sack was the rope, the one Lopin had bought and tossed into the chasm, then stashed down below.
"You haven't lost your wits, have you?"
Lopin asked, eyeing the bones.
"Because if you have, I've got a cousin who makes this drink for people who've lost their wits, and it might make you better, sure."
"If I'd lost my wits," Kaladin said, walking over to a pool of still water to wash off the carapace helm, "would I say that I had?"
"Oh, no, no,"
Lopin said, leaning back.
"Maybe. Guess it doesn't matter if you're crazy or not."
"You'd follow a crazy man into battle?"
"Sure,"
Lopin said.
"If you're crazy, you're a good type, and I like you. Not a killing people in their sleep type of crazy."
He smiled.
"Besides, we all follow crazies all the time. Do it every day with light eyes."
Kaladin chuckled.
"So what's this all for?"
Kaladin didn't answer. He brought the breastplate over to the leather vest, then tied it onto the front with some of the leather straps. He did the same with the cap and the helm, though he eventually had to saw some grooves into the helm with his knife to make it stay. Once done, Kaladin used the last straps to tie the bones together and attach them to the front of the round wooden shield. The bones rattled as he lifted the shield, but he decided it was good enough. He took shield, cap, and breastplate and put them all into Lopin's sack. They barely fit. "All right," he said, standing up. "Syl, lead us to the short chasm." They'd spent some time investigating, finding the best place to launch arrows into the bottom of permanent bridges. One bridge in particular was close to Sadius's war camp, so they often traversed it on the way out on a bridge run and spanned a particularly shallow chasm, only about 40 feet deep, rather than the usual 100 or more. She nodded, then zipped away, leading them there. Kaladin and Lopin followed. Teft had orders to lead the others back and meet Kaladin at the base of the ladder, but Kaladin and Lopin should be far ahead of them. He spent the hike listening with half an ear as Lopin talked about his extended family. The more Kaladin thought about what he was planning, the more brazen it seemed. Perhaps Lopin was right to question his sanity, but Kaladin had tried being rational. He'd tried being careful. That had failed. Now there wasn't any more time for logic or care. Ashal obviously intended Bridge 4 to be exterminated. When clever, careful plans failed, it was time to try something desperate. Lopin cut off suddenly. Kaladin hesitated. The Herdazian man had grown pale-faced and frozen in place. What was... scraping... Kaladin froze as well, a panic rising in him. One of the side corridors echoed with a deep grinding sound. Kaladin turned slowly, just in time to catch sight of something large, no, something enormous, moving down the distant chasm. Shadows in the dim light, the sound of chitinous legs scratching on rock. Kaladin held his breath, sweating, but the beast didn't come in their direction. The scraping grew softer, then eventually faded. He and Lopin stood immobile for a long time after the last sound had vanished. Finally, Lopin spoke.
"Guess the nearby ones aren't all dead, eh, Goncho?"
"Yeah," Kaladin said. He jumped slightly as Syl zipped back to find them. He unconsciously sucked in stormlight as he did so, and when she alighted in the air, she found him sheepishly glowing.
"What is going on?"
she demanded, hands on hips. "Chasm fiend," Kaladin said.
"Really?"
she sounded excited.
"We could chase after it."
"What?"
"Sure," she said. "You could fight it, I'll bet."
"Syl." Her eyes were twinkling with amusement. "Just a joke."
"Come on,"
she zipped away. He and Lopin stepped more softly now. Eventually, Syl landed on the side of the chasm, standing there as if in mockery of when Kaladin had tried to walk up the wall. Kaladin looked up at the shadow of a wooden bridge 40 feet above. This was the shallowest chasm they'd been able to find. They tended to get deeper and deeper the farther eastward you went. More and more, he was certain that trying to escape to the east was impossible. It was too far, and surviving the high storm floods was too difficult a challenge. The original plan, fighting or bribing the guards, then running, was the best one. But they needed to live long enough to try that. The bridge above offered an opportunity, if Kaladin could reach it. He hefted his small bag of spheres and his slung sack full of armor and bones over his shoulder. He'd originally intended to have Rock shoot an arrow with a rope tied to it over the bridge, then back down into the chasm. With some men holding one end, another could have climbed up and tied the sack to the bridge's underside. But that would risk letting an arrow shoot out of the chasm where scouts could see. They were said to be very keen-eyed, as the armies depended on them to spot chasm fiends making chrysalises. Kaladin thought he had a better way than the arrow. Maybe. "We need rocks," he said. "Fist-size ones. A lot of them." Lopin shrugged and began searching about. Kaladin joined him, fishing them out of puddles and pulling them from crevasses. There was no shortage of stones in the chasms. In a short time, he had a large pile of rocks in a sack. He took the pouch of spheres in his hand and tried to think the same way he had earlier when he'd drawn in the stormlight. "This is our last chance. Life before death," he whispered. "Strength before weakness. Journey before destination." The first ideal of the Knight's Radiant. He breathed in deeply, and a thick jolt of power shot up his arm. His muscles burned with energy, with the desire to move. The tempest spread within, pushing at his skin, causing his blood to pump in a powerful rhythm. He opened his eyes. Glowing smoke rose around him. He was able to contain much of the light, holding it in by holding his breath. "It's like a storm inside me." It felt as if it would rip him apart. He set the sack with the armor on the ground, but wound the rope around his arm and tied the sack of rocks to his belt. He took out a single fist-sized stone and hefted it, feeling its storm-smoothed sides. "This had better work." He infused the stone with stormlight, frost crystallizing on his arm. He wasn't sure how he did it, but it felt natural, like pouring liquid into a cup. Light seemed to pool underneath the skin of his hand, then transfer to the rock, as if he were painting it with a vibrant, glowing liquid. He pressed the stone to the rock wall. It fixed in place, leaking stormlight, clinging so strongly that he couldn't pry it free. He tested his weight on it, and it held. He placed another one a little lower, then another a little higher. Then, wishing he had someone to burn him a prayer for success, he started climbing. He tried not to think about what he was doing. Climbing on rocks, stuck to the wall by, what? Light? Spren? He kept on going. It was a lot like climbing the stone formations back near Hearthstone with Tien, except that he could make handholds exactly where he wanted. "Should have found some rock dust to cover my hands," he thought, pulling himself up, then taking another stone from his sack and sticking it into place. Syl walked along beside him, her casual stroll seeming to mock the difficulty of his climb. As he shifted his weight to another rock, he heard an ominous click from below. He risked a glance downward. The first of his rocks had fallen free. The ones near it were leaking stormlight only faintly now. The rocks led up toward him like a set of burning footprints. The storm inside him had quieted, though it still blew and raged inside his veins, thrilling and distracting at the same time. What would happen if he ran out of light before he reached the top? The next rock fell free. The one beside it followed a few seconds later. Lopin stood on the other side of the chasm bottom, leaning against the wall, interested but relaxed. "Keep moving," Kaladin thought, annoyed at himself for getting distracted. He turned back to his work. Just as his arms were beginning to burn from the climb, he reached the underside of the bridge. He reached out as two more of his stones fell free. The clatter of each one was louder now, as they fell a much larger distance. Steadying himself on the bottom of the bridge with one hand, feet still pushing against the highest rocks, he looped the end of the rope around a wooden bridge support. He pulled it around and threaded it through again to make a makeshift knot. He left plenty of extra rope on the short end. He let the rest of the rope slide free of his shoulder and drop to the floor below.
"Lopin," he called.
Light steamed from his mouth as he spoke.
"Pull it tight."
The Herdazian did so, and Kaladin held to his end, making the knot firm. Then he took hold of the long section of rope and let himself swing free, dangling from the bottom of the bridge. The knot held. Kaladin relaxed. He was still steaming light, and, save for the call to Lopin, he'd been holding his breath for a good quarter hour. That could be handy, he thought, though his lungs were starting to burn, so he started to breathe normally. The light didn't leave him altogether, though it escaped faster.
All right, Kaladin said to Lopin. Tie the other sack to the bottom of the rope.
The rope wiggled, and a few moments later, Lopin called up that it was done. Kaladin gripped the rope with his legs to hold himself in place, then used his hands to pull up the length underneath, hoisting up the sack full of armor. Using the rope on the short end of the knot, he slipped his pouch of dun spheres into the sack with the armor, then tied it into place underneath the bridge where, he hoped, Lopin and Dabbid would be able to get it from above. He looked down. The ground looked so much more distant than it would have from the bridge above. From this slightly different perspective, everything changed. He didn't get vertigo from the height. Instead, he felt a little surge of excitement. Something about him had always liked being up high. It felt natural. It was being below, trapped in holes and unable to see the world, that was depressing. He considered his next move.
What?
Syl asked, stepping up to him, standing on air.
If I leave the rope here, someone might spot it while crossing the bridge.
So cut it free.
He looked at her, raising an eyebrow. While dangling from it?
You'll be fine.
That's a 40-foot drop. I'd break bones at the very least.
No, Syl said. I feel right about this, Kaladin. You'll be fine. Trust me.
Trust you. Syl, you've said yourself that your memory is fractured.
You insulted me the other week, she said, folding her arms. I think you owe me an apology.
I'm supposed to apologize by cutting a rope and dropping 40 feet?
No, you apologize by trusting me. I told you. I feel right about this.
He sighed, looking down again. His stormlight was running out. What else could he do? Leaving the rope would be foolish. Could he tie it in another knot? One he could shake free once at the bottom? If that type of knot existed, he didn't know how to tie it. He clenched his teeth. Then, as the last of his rocks fell off and clattered to the ground, he took a deep breath and pulled out the Parshendi knife he'd taken earlier. He moved swiftly before he had a chance to reconsider and sliced the rope free. He dropped in a rush, one hand still holding the sliced rope, stomach lurching with the jarring distress of falling. The bridge shot away as if rising, and Kaladin's panicked mind immediately sent his eyes downward. This wasn't beautiful. This was terrifying. It was horrible. He was going to die.
It's all right.
His emotions calmed in a heartbeat. Somehow he knew what to do. He twisted in the air, dropping the rope and hitting the ground with both feet down. He came to a crouch, resting one hand on the stone, a jolt of coldness shooting through him. His remaining stormlight came out in a single burst, flung from his body in a luminescent smoke ring that crashed against the ground before spreading out, vanishing. He stood up straight. Lopin gaped. Kaladin felt an ache in his legs from hitting, but it was like that of having leaped 4 or 5 feet.
Like 10 crashes of thunder on the mounts, Goncho,
Lopin exclaimed.
That was incredible.
Thank you, Kaladin said.
He raised a hand to his head, glancing at the rocks scattered above the base of the wall, then looking up at the armor tied securely up above.
I told you,
she said, landing on his shoulder. She sounded triumphant. Lopin, Kaladin said. You think you can get that bundle of armor during the next bridge run?
Sure,
Lopin said.
Nobody will see. They ignore us, Hurties. They ignore Bridgman, and they especially ignore cripples. To them, I'm so invisible I should be walking through walls.
Kaladin nodded. Get it. Hide it. Give it to me right before the final plateau assault.
They aren't going to like you going into a bridge run armored, Goncho, Lopin said. I don't think this will be any different from what you tried before.
We'll see, Kaladin said. Just do it.
Sixty. That which we cannot have. The death is my life. The strength becomes my weakness. The journey has ended. Dated Beta Banis, 1173, 95 seconds pre-death. Subject a scholar of some minor renown. Sample collected second hand. Considered questionable.
That is why, Father, Adolin said, you absolutely cannot abdicate to me no matter what we discover with the visions.
Is that so? Dalinar asked, smiling to himself.
Yes.
Very well. You've convinced me.
Adolin stopped dead in the hallway. The two of them were on their way to Dalinar's chambers. Dalinar turned and looked back at the younger man.
Really? Adolin asked. I mean, I actually won an argument with you?
Yes, Dalinar said. Your points are valid. He didn't add that he'd come to the decision on his own. No matter what, I will stay. I can't leave this fight now.
Adolin smiled broadly.
But, Dalinar said, raising a finger, I have a requirement. I will draft an order, notarized by the highest of my scribes and witnessed by Elokar, that gives you the right to depose me should I grow too mentally unstable. We won't let the other camps know of it, but I will not risk letting myself get so crazy that it's impossible to remove me.
All right,
Adolin said, walking up to Dalinar. They were alone in the hallway.
I can accept that.
Assuming you don't tell Sadeus about it. I still don't trust him.
I'm not asking you to trust him, Dalinar said, pushing the door open to his chambers. You just need to believe that he is capable of changing. Sadeus was once a friend, and I think he can be again.
The cool stones of the soul-cast chamber seemed to hold the chill of the spring weather. It continued to refuse to slip into summer, but at least it hadn't slid into winter either. Elthabar promised that it would not do so, but then the Storm Warden's promises were always filled with caveats. The Almighty's will was mysterious, and the signs couldn't always be trusted. He accepted Storm Wardens now, though when they'd first grown popular, he'd rejected their aid. No man should try to know the future nor lay claim to it, for it belonged only to the Almighty himself, and Dalinar wondered how Storm Wardens could do their research without reading. They claimed they didn't, but he'd seen their books filled with glyphs. Glyphs. They weren't meant to be used in books, they were pictures. A man who had never seen one before could still understand what one meant, based on its shape. That made interpreting glyphs different from reading. Storm Wardens did a lot of things that made people uncomfortable. Unfortunately, they were just so useful. Knowing when a high storm might strike, well, that was just too tempting an advantage. Even though Storm Wardens were frequently wrong, they were more often right. Renarin knelt beside the hearth, inspecting the fabrial that had been installed there to warm the room. Navani had already arrived. She sat at Dalinar's elevated writing desk, scribbling a letter. She waved a distracted greeting with her reed as Dalinar entered. She wore the fabrial he had seen her displaying at the feast a few weeks back. The multi-legged contraption was attached to her shoulder, gripping the cloth of her violet dress.
I don't know, Father, Adolin said, closing the door. Apparently he was still thinking about Sadeus. I don't care if he's listening to the Way of Kings. He's just doing it to make you look less closely at the plateau assaults so that his clerks can arrange his cut of the gem hearts more favorably.
He's manipulating you.
Dalinar shrugged. Gem hearts are secondary, son. If I can reforge an alliance with him, then it's worth nearly any cost. In a way, I'm the one manipulating him.
Adolin sighed.
Very well. But I'm still going to keep a hand on my money pouch when he's near.
Just try not to insult him, Dalinar said.
Oh, and something else. I would like you to take extra care with the King's Guard. If there are soldiers we know for certain are loyal to me, put those in charge of guarding Elokar's rooms. His words about a conspiracy have me worried.
Surely you don't give them credence, Adolin said.
Something odd did happen with his armor. This whole mess stinks like creme slime. Perhaps it will turn out to be nothing. For now, humor me.
I have to note, Navani said, that I didn't much care for Sadeus back when you, he, and Gavilar were friends.
She finished her letter with a flourish.
He's not behind the attacks on the king, Dalinar said.
How can you be certain? Navani asked.
Because it's not his way, Dalinar said. Sadeus never wanted the title of king. Being High Prince gives him plenty of power, but leaves him with someone to take the blame for large-scale mistakes.
Dalinar shook his head.
He never tried to seize the throne from Gavilar, and he's even better positioned with Elokar.
Because my son's a weakling, Navani said.
It wasn't an accusation.
He's not weak, Dalinar said. He's inexperienced. But yes, that does make the situation ideal for Sadeus. He's telling the truth. He asked to be High Prince of Information because he wants very badly to find out who is trying to kill Elokar.
Mashala,
Renarin said, using the formal term for aunt.
That fabrial on your shoulder. What does it do?
Navani looked down at the device with a sly smile. Dalinar could see she'd been hoping one of them would ask. Dalinar sat down. The high storm would be coming soon.
Oh, this? It's a typical pain reel. Here, let me show you.
She reached up with her safe hand, pushing a clip that released the claw-like legs. She held it up.
Do you have any aches, dear? A stubbed toe, perhaps, or a scrape?
Renarin shook his head.
I pulled a muscle in my hand during dueling practice earlier, Adolin said. It's not bad, but it does ache.
Come over here, Navani said.
Dalinar smiled fondly. Navani was always at her most genuine when playing with new fabrials. It was one of the few times when one got to see her without any pretense. This wasn't Navani the king's mother or Navani the political schemer. This was Navani the excited engineer.
The Artifabrian community is doing some amazing things, Navani said as Adolin proffered his hand. I'm particularly proud of this little device, as I had a hand in its construction.
She clipped it onto Adolin's hand, wrapping the claw-like legs around the palm and locking them into place. Adolin raised his hand, turning it around.
The pain is gone.
But you can still feel, correct?
Navani said in a self-satisfied way. Adolin prodded his palm with the fingers of his other hand.
The hand isn't numb at all.
Renarin watched with keen interest, bespectacled eyes curious, intense. If only the lad could be persuaded to become an Ardent. He could be an engineer then if he wanted. And yet he refused. His reasons always seemed like poor excuses to Dalinar.
It's kind of bulky, Dalinar noted.
Well, it's just an early model, Navani said defensively. I was working backward from one of those dreadful creations of Long Shadows, and I didn't have the luxury of refining the shape. I think it has a lot of potential. Imagine a few of these on a battlefield to dull the pain of wounded soldiers. Imagine it in the hands of a surgeon who wouldn't have to worry about his patient's pain while working on them.
Adolin nodded. Dalinar had to admit it did sound like a useful device. Navani smiled.
This is a special time to be alive. We're learning all kinds of things about fabrials.
This, for instance, is a diminishing fabrial. It decreases something, in this case pain. It doesn't actually make the wound any better, but it might be a step in that direction. Either way, it's a completely different type from paired fabrials like the span reeds. If you could see the plans we have for the future.
Like what? Adolin asked.
You'll find out eventually, Navani said, smiling mysteriously.
She removed the fabrial from Adolin's hand.
Shard blades? Adolin sounded excited. Well, no, Navani said. The design and workings of shard blades and plate are completely different from everything we've discovered. The closest anyone has are those shields in Yakaved. But as far as I can tell, they use a completely different design principle from regular shard plate. The ancients must have had a wondrous grasp of engineering.
No, Dalinar said. I've seen them, Navani. They're ancient. Their technology is primitive.
And the Dawn Cities? Navani asked skeptically. The Fabrials?
Dalinar shook his head. I've seen neither. There are shard blades in the visions, but they seem so out of place. Perhaps they were given directly by the heralds, as the legends say.
Perhaps, Navani said. Why don't...
She vanished. Dalinar blinked. He hadn't heard the high storm approaching. He was now in a large, open room with pillars running along the sides. The enormous pillars looked sculpted of soft sandstone, with unornamented, granular sides. The ceiling was far above, carved from the rock and geometric patterns that looked faintly familiar. Circles connected by lines, spreading outward from one another.
I don't know what to do, old friend, a voice said from the side.
Dalinar turned to see a youthful man in regal white and gold robes walking with his hands clasped before him, hidden by voluminous sleeves. He had dark hair pulled back in a braid, and a short beard that came to a point. Gold threads were woven into his hair and came together on his forehead to form a golden symbol, the symbol of the Knight's Radiant.
They say that each time it is the same, the man said. We are never ready for desolations. We should be getting better at resisting, but each time we step closer to destruction instead.
He turned to Dalinar as if expecting a response. Dalinar glanced down. He too wore ornamental robes, though not as lavish. Where was he? What time? He needed to find clues for Navani to record, and for Yasna to use in proving or disproving these dreams.
I don't know what to say either, Dalinar responded.
If he wanted information, he needed to act more natural than he had in previous visions. The regal man sighed.
I had hoped you would have wisdom to share with me, Karm.
They continued walking toward the side of the room, approaching a place where the wall split into a massive balcony with a stone railing. It looked out upon an evening sky. The setting sun stained the air a dirty, sultry red.
Our own natures destroy us, the regal man said, voice soft, though his face was angry. Alakavish was a surge binder. He should have known better. And yet the Nile bond gave him no more wisdom than a regular man. Alas, not all Spren are as discerning as Honor Spren.
I agree, Dalinar said. The other man looked relieved.
I worried that you would find my claims too forward. Your own surge binders were... But no, we should not look backward.
What's a surge binder? Dalinar wanted to scream the question out, but there was no way, not without sounding completely out of place.
Perhaps. What do you think should be done with these surge binders? Dalinar asked carefully. I don't know if we can force them to do anything.
Their footsteps echoed in the empty room. Were there no guards, no attendants?
Their power... Well, Alakavish proves the allure that surge binders have for the common people.
If only there was a way to encourage them.
The man stopped, turning to Dalinar.
They need to be better, old friend. We all do. The responsibility of what we've been given, whether it be the crown or the Nile bond, needs to make us better.
He seemed to expect something from Dalinar, but what?
I can read your disagreement in your face, the regal man said. It's all right, Carm. I realize that my thoughts on this subject are unconventional. Perhaps the rest of you are right. Perhaps our abilities are proof of a divine mantle. But if this is true, should we not be more wary of how we act?
Dalinar frowned. That sounded familiar to him. The regal man sighed, walking to the balcony lip. Dalinar joined him, stepping outside. The perspective finally allowed him to look down at the landscape below. Thousands of corpses confronted him. Dalinar gasped. Dead filled the streets of the city outside, a city that Dalinar vaguely recognized. Kolinar, he thought. My homeland. He stood with the regal man at the top of a low tower, 3 stories high, a keep of some sort, constructed of stone. It seemed to sit where the palace would someday be. The city was unmistakable, with its peaked stone formations rising like enormous fins into the air. The wind blades, they were called. But they were less weathered than he was accustomed to, and the city around them was very different. Built of blocky stone structures, many of which had been knocked down. The destruction spread far, lining the sides of primitive streets. Had the city been hit by an earthquake? No. Those corpses had fallen in battle. Dalinar could smell the stench of blood, viscera, smoke. The bodies lay strewn about, many near the low wall that surrounded the keep. The wall was broken in places, smashed, and there were rocks of strange shape mixed about the corpses. Stones cut like blood of my fathers, Dalinar thought, gripping the stone railing, leaning forward. Those aren't stones. They're creatures. Massive creatures, easily 5 or 6 times the size of a person, their skin dull and gray like granite. They had long limbs and skeletal bodies, the forelegs, or were they arms, set into wide shoulders. The faces were lean, narrow, arrow-like.
What happened here? Dalinar asked, despite himself. It's terrible. I ask myself this same thing. How could we let this occur? The desolations are well named. I've heard initial counts. 11 years of war and 9 out of 10 people I once ruled are dead. Do we even have kingdoms to lead any longer? Sur is gone, I'm sure of it. Tarma, Ilis, they won't likely survive. Too many of their people have fallen.
Dalinar had never heard of those places. The man made a fist, pounding it softly against the railing. Burning stations had been set up in the distance. They had begun cremating the corpses.
The others want to blame Alakavish. And true, if he hadn't brought us to war before the desolation, we might not have been broken this badly. But Alakavish was a symptom of a greater disease. When the heralds next return, what will they find? A people who have forgotten them yet again? A world torn by war and squabbling? If we continue as we have, then perhaps we deserve to lose.
Dalinar felt a chill. He had thought that this vision must come after his previous one, but prior visions hadn't been chronological. He hadn't seen any Knights Radiant yet, but that might not be because they had disbanded. Perhaps they didn't exist yet, and perhaps there was a reason this man's words sounded so familiar.
Could it be? Could he really be standing beside the very man whose words Dalinar had listened to time and time again? There is honor in loss, Dalinar said carefully,
using words repeated several times in the way of kings.
If that loss brings learning, the man smiled. Using my own sayings against me again, Karm?
Dalinar felt himself grow short of breath. The man himself. Noadon, the great king. He was real. Or he had been real. This man was younger than Dalinar had imagined him, but that humble yet regal bearing. Yes, it was right.
I'm thinking of giving up my throne, Noadon said softly.
No, Dalinar stepped toward him. You mustn't.
I cannot lead them, the man said. Not if this is what my leadership brings them to.
Noadon.
The man turned to him, frowning.
What?
Dalinar paused. Could he be wrong about this man's identity? But no. The name Noadon was more of a title. Many famous people in history had been given holy names by the church before it was disbanded. Even Bajerdin wasn't likely to be his real name. That was lost in time.
It is nothing, Dalinar said. You cannot give up your throne. The people need a leader.
They have leaders, Noadon said. There are princes, kings, soul casters, surge binders. We never lack men and women who wish to lead.
True, Dalinar said. But we do lack ones who are good at it.
Noadon leaned over the railing. He stared at the fallen, an expression of deep grief and trouble on his face. It was so strange to see the man like this. He was so young. Dalinar had never imagined such insecurity, such torment in him.
I know that feeling, Dalinar said softly. The uncertainty, the shame, the confusion.
You can read me too well, old friend.
I know these emotions because I've felt them. I never assumed that you would feel them too.
Then I correct myself. Perhaps you don't know me well enough.
Dalinar fell silent.
So what do I do? Noadon asked. You're asking me? You're my advisor, aren't you? Well, I should like some advice. You can't give up your throne.
And what should I do with it?
Noadon turned and walked along the long balcony. It seemed to run around this entire level. Dalinar joined him, passing places where the stone was ripped, the railing broken away.
I haven't faith in people any longer, old friend, Noadon said. Put two men together and they will find something to argue about. Gather them into groups and one group will find reason to oppress or attack another. Now this. How do I protect them? How do I stop this from happening again?
You dictate a book, Dalinar said eagerly. A grand book, to give people hope, to explain your philosophy on leadership and how lives should be lived.
A book? Me? Write a book? Why not? Because it's a fantastically stupid idea.
Dalinar's jaw dropped.
The world as we know it has quite nearly been destroyed, Noadon said. Barely a family exists that hasn't lost half its members. Our best men are corpses on that field, and we haven't food to last more than 2 or 3 months at best. And I'm to spend my time writing a book? Who would scribe it for me? All of my wordsmen were slaughtered when Yelignar broke into the chancery. You're the only man of letters I know of who's still alive.
A man of letters? This was an odd time.
I could write it then.
With one arm. Have you learned to write left-handed then?
Dalinar looked down. He had both of his arms, though apparently the man Noadon saw was missing his right.
No. We need to rebuild, Noadon said. I just wish there were a way to convince the kings, the ones still alive, not to seek advantage over one another.
Noadon tapped the balcony.
So this is my decision. Step down or do what is needed. This isn't a time for writing. It's a time for action. And then, unfortunately, a time for the sword.
The sword, Dalinar thought. From you, Noadon?
It wouldn't happen. This man would become a great philosopher. He would teach peace and reverence for others, and would not force men to do as he wished. He would guide them to acting with honor.
Noadon turned to Dalinar.
I apologize, Karm. I should not dismiss your suggestions right after asking for them. I'm on edge, as I imagine that we all are. At times it seems to me that to be human is to want that which we cannot have. For some, this is power. For me, it is peace.
Noadon turned, walking back down the balcony. Though his pace was slow, his posture indicated that he wished to be alone. Dalinar let him go.
He goes on to become one of the most influential writers Roshar has ever known, Dalinar said.
There was silence, save for the calls of the people working below gathering the corpses.
I know you're there, Dalinar said.
Silence.
What does he decide? Dalinar asked. Did he unite them, as he wanted?
The voice that often spoke in his visions did not come. Dalinar received no answer to his questions. He sighed, turning to look out over the fields of dead.
You're right about one thing, at least, Noadon. To be human is to want that which we cannot have.
The landscape darkened, the sun setting. That darkness enveloped him, and he closed his eyes. When he opened them, he was back in his rooms, standing with his hands on the back of a chair. He turned to Adolin and Renarin, who stood nearby, anxious, prepared to grab him if he got violent.
Well, Dalinar said, that was meaningless. I learned nothing. Blast. I'm doing a poor job of...
Dalinar,
Navani said curtly, still scribbling with a reed at her paper.
The last thing you said before the vision ended. What was it?
Dalinar frowned.
The last?
Yes,
Navani said, urgent.
The very last words you spoke.
I was quoting the man I'd been speaking with. To be human is to want that which we cannot have. Why?
She ignored him, writing furiously. Once done, she slid off the high-legged chair, hurrying to his bookshelf.
Do you have a copy of... Yes, I thought you might. These are Yasna's books, aren't they?
Yes, Dalinar said. She wanted them cared for until she returned.
Navani pulled a volume off the shelf.
Corvana's Analectics.
She set the volume on the writing desk and leafed through the pages. Dalinar joined her, though, of course, he couldn't make sense of the page.
What does it matter?
Here,
Navani said. She looked up at Dalinar.
When you go into these visions of yours, you know that you speak.
Gibberish. Yes, my sons have told me.
Anak Malakaf, Delmachian Haben Ya,
Navani said.
Sound familiar?
Dalinar shook his head, baffled.
It sounds a lot like what Father was saying,
Renarin said, when he was in the vision.
Not a lot like Renarin,
Navani said, looking smug.
It's exactly the same phrase. That is the last thing you said before coming out of your trance. I wrote down everything, as best I could, that you babbled today.
For what purpose? Dalinar asked.
Because, Navani said, I thought it might be helpful. And it was. The same phrase is in the Analectics, almost exactly.
What?
Dalinar asked, incredulous.
How?
It's a line from a song, Navani said. A chant by the Vanriel, an order of artists who live on the slopes of the Silent Mount in Yakaved. Year after year, century after century, they've sung these same words. Songs they claim were written in the dawn chant by the heralds themselves. They have the words of those songs, written in an ancient script. But the meanings have been lost. They're just sounds now. Some scholars believe that the script and the songs themselves may indeed be in the dawn chant.
And I, Dalinar said.
You just spoke a line from one of them, Navani said. Beyond that, if the phrase you just gave me is correct, you translated it. This could prove the Vanriel hypothesis. One sentence isn't much, but it could give us the key to translating the entire script. It has been itching at me for a while, listening to these visions. I thought the things you were saying had too much order to be gibberish.
She looked at Dalinar, smiling deeply.
Dalinar, you might just have cracked one of the most perplexing and ancient mysteries of all time.
Wait, Adolin said. What are you saying?
What I'm saying, nephew, Navani said, looking directly at him, is that we have your proof.
But, Adolin said, I mean, he could have heard that one phrase
and extrapolated an entire language from it,
Navani said, holding up a sheet full of writings.
This is not gibberish, but it's no language that people now speak. I suspect it is what it seems, the dawn chant. So unless you can think of another way your father learned to speak a dead language, Adolin, the visions are most certainly real.
The room fell silent. Navani herself looked stunned by what she had said. She shook it off quickly.
Now, Dalinar, she said, I want you to describe this vision as accurately as possible. I need the exact words you spoke, if you can recall them. Every bit we gather will help my scholars sort through this.
Sixty-one. Right for wrong.
In the storm I awaken, falling, spinning, grieving.
Dated Kakanev, 1173. 13 seconds pre-death. Subject was a city guardsman.
How can you be so sure it was him, Dalinar?
Navani asked softly. Dalinar shook his head.
I just am. That was Noadan.
It had been several hours since the end of the vision. Navani had left her writing table to sit in a more comfortable chair near Dalinar. Renarin sat across from him, accompanying them for propriety's sake. Adolin had left to get the high storm damage report. The lad had seemed very disturbed by the discovery that the visions were real.
But the man you saw never spoke his name, Navani said.
It was him, Navani.
Dalinar stared toward the wall over Renarin's head, looking at the smooth brown silcast rock.
There was an aura of command about him, the weight of great responsibilities, a regality.
It could have been some other king, she said. After all, he discarded your suggestion that he write a book.
It just wasn't the time for him to write it yet. So much death. He was cast down by some great loss. Stormfather, 9 out of 10 people dead in war? Can you imagine such a thing?
The desolations, Navani said.
Unite the people. The true desolation comes.
Do you know of any references to the desolations? Dalinar asked. Not the tales Ardens tell. Historical references. Navani held a cup of warmed violet wine in her hand, beads of condensation on the rim of a glass.
Yes, but I am the wrong one to ask. Yasna is the historian.
I think I saw the aftermath of one. I may have seen corpses of Voidbringers. Could that give us more proof?
Nothing nearly as good as the linguistics.
Navani took a sip of her wine.
The desolations are matters of ancient lore. It could be argued that you imagined what you expected to see.
but those words. If we can translate them, nobody will be able to dispute that you are seeing something real.
Her writing board lay on the low table between them, reed and ink set carefully across the paper.
You intend to tell others? Dalinar asked. Of my visions? How else will we explain what is happening to you?
Dalinar hesitated.
How could he explain?
On one hand, it was relieving to know that he was not mad.
But what if some force were trying to mislead him with these visions, using images of Noadon and the Radiance because he would find them trustworthy?
The Knights Radiant fell, Dalinar reminded himself. They abandoned us. Some of the other orders may have turned against us, as the legends say. There was an unsettling edge to all of that. He had another stone in rebuilding the foundation of who he was, but the most important point still remained undecided. Did he trust his visions or not? He couldn't go back to believing them unquestioningly, not now that Adolin's challenges had raised real worries in his head. Until he knew their source, he felt he shouldn't spread knowledge of them.
Dalinar, Novani said, leaning forward, the war camps speak of your episodes. Even the wives of your officers are uncomfortable. They think you fear the storms, or that you have some disease of the mind. This will vindicate you.
How? By making me into some kind of mystic? Many will think that the breeze of these visions blows too close to prophecy.
You see the past, Father, Renarin said. That is not forbidden. And if the Almighty sends them, then how could men question?
Adolin and I both spoke with Ardens, Dalinar replied. They said it was very unlikely that this would come from the Almighty. If we do decide the visions are to be trusted, many will disagree with me.
Navani settled back, sipping her wine, safe hand lying across her lap. Dalinar, your sons told me that you once sought the old magic. Why? What did you ask of the Night Watcher? And what curse did she give you in return?
I told them that my shame is my own, Dalinar said, and I will not share it.
The room fell silent. The flurries of rain following the high storm had ceased falling on the roof. It might be important, Navani finally said.
It was long ago, long before the visions began. I don't think it's related.
But it could be.
Yes, he admitted. Would that day never stop haunting him? Was not losing all memory of his wife enough?
What did Renarin think? Would he condemn his father for such an egregious sin?
Dalinar forced himself to look up and meet his son's bespectacled eyes.
Curiously, Renarin didn't seem bothered, just thoughtful.
I'm sorry you had to discover my shame, Dalinar said, looking to Navani.
She waved indifferently. Soliciting the old magic is offensive to the devotaries, but their punishments for the act are never severe. I assume that you didn't have to do much to be cleansed.
The Ardents asked for spheres to give the poor, Dalinar said. And I had to commission a series of prayers. None of that removed the effects or my sense of guilt.
I think you'd be surprised at how many devout light eyes turned to the old magic at one point in their lives or another. The ones who can make their way to the valley, at least. But I do wonder if this is related. Aunt, Renarin said, turning to her, I have recently asked for a number of readings about the old magic. I agree with his assessment. This does not feel like the work of the Night Watcher. She gives curses in exchange for granting small desires. Always one curse and one desire. Father, I assume you know what both of those things are?
Yes, he said. I know exactly what my curse was, and it does not relate to this.
Then it is unlikely that the old magic is to blame.
Yes, Dalinar said. But your aunt is right to question. The truth is, we don't have any proof that this came from the Almighty either.
Something wants me to know of the desolations in the Night's Radiant. Perhaps we should start asking ourselves why that is.
What were the desolations, Aunt?
Renarin asked.
The Ardents talk of the Voidbringers, of mankind and the Radiance, and of fighting. But what were they really? Do we know anything specific?
There are folklorists among your father's clerks who would serve you better in this matter.
Perhaps, Dalinar nodded, but I'm not sure which of them I can trust.
Navani paused.
Fair enough. Well, from what I understand, there are no primary accounts remaining. This was long, long ago. I do recall that the myth of Parasaphi and Nadris mentions the desolations.
Parasaphi, Renarin said. She's the one who searched out the seed stones.
Yes,
Navani replied.
In order to repopulate her fallen people, she climbed the peaks of Dera. The myth changes, listing different modern mountain ranges as the true peaks of Dera, to find stones touched by the heralds themselves. She brought them to Nadris on his deathbed and harvested his seed to bring life to the stones. They hatched forth 10 children, which she used to found a new nation. Marna, I believe it was called.
Origin of the Makabaki, Renarin said. Mother told me that story when I was a child.
Dalinar shook his head. Born from rocks?
The old stories rarely made much sense to him, although the Devoteries had canonized many of them.
The story mentions the desolations at the beginning, Navani said, giving them credit for having wiped out Parasaphi's people.
But what were they?
Wars.
Navani took a sip of wine.
The Voidbringers came again and again, trying to force mankind off Roshar and into damnation, just as they once forced mankind, and the Heralds, out of the Tranquiline Halls.
When were the Knights Radiant founded? Dalinar asked.
Navani shrugged.
I don't know. Perhaps they were some military group from a specific kingdom, or perhaps they were originally a mercenary band. That would make it easy to see how they could eventually become tyrants.
My visions don't imply that they were tyrants, he said. Perhaps that is the true purpose of the visions, to make me believe lies about the Radiance, making me trust them, perhaps trying to lead me to mimic their downfall and betrayal.
I don't know,
Navani said, sounding skeptical.
I don't think you've seen anything untrue about the Radiance. The legends tend to agree that the Radiance weren't always so bad, as much as the legends agree on anything, at least.
Dalinar stood and took her nearly empty cup, then walked over to the serving table and refilled it. Discovering that he was not mad should have helped clear things up, but instead left him more disturbed. What if the Voidbringers were behind the visions? Some stories he heard said that they could possess the bodies of men and make them do evil. Or, if they were from the Almighty, what was their purpose?
I need to think on all of this, he said. It's been a long day. Please, if I could be left to my own thoughts now.
Renarin rose and bowed his head in respect before heading to the door. Navani rose more slowly, sleek dress rustling as she set her cup on the table, then walked over to fetch her pain-drinking Fabriel. Renarin left, and Dalinar walked to the doorway, waiting as Navani approached. He didn't intend to let her trap him alone again. He looked out the doorway. His soldiers were there, and he could see them. Good.
Aren't you pleased at all?
Navani asked, lingering beside the doorway near him, one hand on the frame.
Pleased?
You aren't going mad.
And we don't know if I'm being manipulated or not, he said. In a way, we have more questions now than we had before.
The visions are a blessing,
Navani said, laying her free hand on his arm.
I feel it, Dalinar. Don't you see how wonderful this is?
Dalinar met her eyes, light violet, beautiful. She was so thoughtful,
so clever. How he wished he could trust her completely. She has shown me nothing but honor, he thought, never speaking a word to anyone else of my intention to abdicate. She hasn't so much as tried to use my visions against me. He felt ashamed that he'd once worried that she might. She was a wonderful woman, Novani Kolin. A wonderful, amazing, dangerous woman. I see more worries, he said, and more danger.
But Dalinar, you're having experiences scholars, historians, and folklorists could only dream about. I envy you, although you claim to have seen no fabrials of note.
The ancients don't have fabrials, Navani. I'm certain of it.
And that changes everything we thought we understood about them.
I suppose.
Stonefalls, Dalinar, she said, sighing. Does nothing bring you to passion any longer?
Dalinar took a deep breath. Too many things, Navani. My insides feel like a mass of eels, emotions squirming over one another. The truth of these visions is unsettling.
It's exciting, she corrected. Did you mean what you said earlier? About trusting me?
I said that.
You said you didn't trust your clerks, and you asked me to record the visions. There's an implication in that.
Her hand was still on his arm. She reached out with her safe hand and closed the door to the hallway. He almost stopped her, but he hesitated. Why? The door clicked closed. They were alone. And she was so beautiful. Those clever, excitable eyes, alight with passion. Navani, Dalinar said, forcing down his desire. You're doing it again.
Why did he let her? Yes, I am, she said. I'm a stubborn woman, Dalinar.
There didn't seem to be any playfulness in her tone. This is not proper. My brother. He reached for the door to open it again.
Your brother,
Navani spat, expression flashing with anger.
Why must everyone always focus on him? Everyone always worries so much about the man who died. He's not here, Dalinar. He's gone. I miss him, but not half as much as you do, it appears.
I honor his memory, Dalinar said stiffly, hesitating, hand on the door's latch.
That's fine. I'm happy you do. But it's been 6 years. And all anyone can see me as is the wife of a dead man. The other women, they humor me with idle gossip, but they won't let me into their political circles. They think I'm a relic. You wanted to know why I came back so quickly? I returned, she said, because I have no home. I'm expected to sit out of important events because my husband is dead. Lounge around, pampered but ignored. I make them uncomfortable. The queen, the other women at court.
I'm sorry, Dalinar said, but I don't. She raised her free hand, tapping him on the chest.
I won't take it from you, Dalinar. We were friends before I even met Gavilar. You still know me as me, not some shadow of a dynasty that crumbled years ago. Don't you?
She looked at him, pleading. Blood of my fathers, Dalinar thought with shock. She's crying. Two small tears. He had rarely seen her so sincere. And so he kissed her. It was a mistake. He knew it was. He grabbed her anyway, pulling her into a rough, tight embrace and pressing his mouth to hers, unable to contain himself. She melted against him. He tasted the salt of her tears as they ran down to her lips and met his. It lasted long, too long, wonderfully long. His mind screamed at him like a prisoner chained in a cell and forced to watch something horrible. But a part of him had wanted this for decades. Decades spent watching his brother court, marry, and then hold the only woman that the young Dalinar had ever wanted. He'd told himself he would never allow this. He had denied himself feelings for Navani the moment Gavilar had won her hand. Dalinar had stepped aside.
but the taste of her, the smell of her, the warmth of her pressed against him was too sweet. Like a blossoming perfume, it washed away the guilt. For a moment, that touch banished everything. He couldn't remember his fear at the visions, his worry about Sadeus, his shame at past mistakes. He could only think of her. Beautiful, insightful, delicate yet strong at once. He clung to her, something he could hold on to as the rest of the world churned around him. Eventually, he broke the kiss. She looked up at him, dazed. Passion spren, like tiny flakes of crystalline snow, floated down in the air around them. Guilt flooded him again. He tried gently to push her away, but she clung to him, holding on tight. "Navani," he said.
"Hush."
She pressed her head against his chest.
"We can't." "Hush,"
she said more insistently. He sighed, but let himself hold her.
"Something is going wrong in this world, Dalinar,"
Navani said softly.
"The king of Yakaved was assassinated. I heard it just today. He was killed by a Shin shardbearer in white clothing."
"Stormfather," Dalinar said.
"Something's going on," she said. "Something bigger than our war here. Something bigger than Gavilar. Have you heard of the twisted things men say when they die? Most ignore it, but surgeons are talking, and storm wardens whisper that the high storms are growing more powerful."
"I have heard," he said, finding it difficult to get the words out, intoxicated by her as he was.
"My daughter seeks something," Navani said. "She frightens me sometimes. She's so intense. I honestly believe she's the most intelligent person I've ever known. And the things she searches for. Dalinar, she believes that something very dangerous is near."
"The sun approaches the horizon. The Everstorm comes. The true desolation. The night of sorrows."
"I need you,"
Navani said.
"I've known it for years, though I feared it would destroy you with guilt, so I fled. But I couldn't stay away. Not with the way they treat me. Not with what is happening to the world. I'm terrified, Dalinar, and I need you. Gavilar was not the man everyone thought him to be. I was fond of him, but he..."
"Please," Dalinar said. "Don't speak ill of him."
"Very well."
"Blood of my fathers." He couldn't get her scent out of his head. He felt paralyzed, holding to her like a man clinging to a stone in the storm winds. She looked up at him.
"Well, let it be said, then, that I was fond of Gavilar. But I'm more fond of you. And I'm tired of waiting."
He closed his eyes. "How can this work?"
"We'll find a way."
"We'll be denounced."
"The war camps already ignore me," Navani said. "And they spread rumors and lies about you. What more can they do to us?"
"They'll find something. As of yet, the Devoteries do not condemn me."
"Gavilar is dead,"
Navani said, resting her head back against his chest.
"I was never unfaithful while he lived, though the Stormfather knows I had ample reason. The Devoteries can say what they wish, but the arguments do not forbid our union. Tradition is not the same as doctrine, and I will not hold myself back for fear of offending."
Dalinar took a deep breath, then forced himself to open his arms and pull back. "If you had hoped to soothe my worries for the day, then this didn't help." She folded her arms. He could still feel where her safe hand had touched him on the back. A tender touch, reserved for a family member.
"I'm not here to soothe you, Dalinar. Quite the opposite."
"Please. I do need time to think."
"I won't let you put me away. I won't ignore that this happened. I won't..."
"Navani," he gently cut her off. "I will not abandon you. I promise. She eyed him, then a wry smile crept onto her face.
Very well. But you began something today.
I began it, he asked, amused, elated, confused, worried, and ashamed at the same time.
The kiss was yours, Dalinar, she said idly, pulling open the door and entering his antechamber.
You seduced me to it.
What? Seduced? She glanced back at him. Dalinar, I've never been more open and honest in my life.
I know, Dalinar said, smiling. That was the seductive part. He closed the door softly, then let out a sigh. Blood of my fathers, he thought. Why can't these things ever be simple? And yet, in direct contrast with his thoughts, he felt as if the entire world had somehow become more right for having gone wrong.
Three glyphs. The darkness becomes a palace. Let it rule. Let it rule.
Kakava, 1173. 22 seconds pre-death. A dark-eyed Selai man of unknown profession.
You think one of those will save us? Moash asked, scowling as he looked at the prayer tied about Kaladin's upper right arm.
Kaladin glanced to the side. He stood at parade rest as Sadius's soldiers crossed their bridge. The chilly spring air felt good, now that he'd started working. The sky was bright, cloudless, and the storm wardens promised that no high storm was near. The prayer tied in his arms was simple. Three glyphs. Wind, protection, beloved. A prayer to Ysereza, the Storm Father, to protect loved ones and friends. It was the straightforward type his mother had preferred. For all her subtlety and wryness, whenever she'd knitted or written a prayer, it had been simple and heartfelt. Wearing it reminded him of her.
I can't believe you paid good money for that, Moash said. If there are heralds watching, they don't pay any mind to Bridgman.
I've been feeling nostalgic lately, I guess.
The prayer was probably meaningless, but he'd had reason to start thinking more about religion lately. The life of a slave made it difficult for many to believe that anyone, or anything, was watching. Yet many Bridgemen had grown more religious during their captivity. Two groups, opposite reactions. Did that mean some were stupid and others were callous? Or something else entirely?
They're going to see us dead, you know, Dre said from behind. This is it.
The Bridgemen were exhausted. Kaladin and his team had been forced to work the chasms all night. Ashal had put strict requirements on them, demanding an increased amount of salvage. In order to meet the quota, they'd foregone training to scavenge. And then today, they'd been awakened for a morning chasm assault after only 3 hours of sleep. They were drooping as they stood in line, and they hadn't even reached the contested plateau yet.
Let it come, Scar said quietly from the other side of the line. They want us dead? Well, I'm not going to back down. We'll show them what courage is. They can hide behind our bridges while we charge. That's no victory, Moash said. I say we attack the soldiers right now.
Our own troops, Sigzel said, turning his dark-skinned head and looking down the line of men.
Sure, Moash said, eyes still forward. They're going to kill us anyway. Let's take a few of them with us. Damnation, why not charge Sadius? His guard won't expect it. I'll bet we could knock down a few and grab their spears, then be on to killing Light Eyes before they cut us down.
A couple of Bridgemen murmured their assent as the soldiers continued to cross.
No, Kaladin said. It won't accomplish anything. They'd have us dead before we so much as inconvenience Sadius.
Moash spat.
And this will accomplish something? Damnation, Kaladin, I feel like I'm already dangling from the noose.
I have a plan, Kaladin said.
He waited for the objections. His other plans hadn't worked. No one offered a complaint.
Well then, Moash said, what is it?
You'll see today, Kaladin said. If it works, it'll buy us time. If it fails, I'll be dead. He turned to look down the line of faces. In that case, Teft has orders to lead you on an escape attempt tonight. You're not ready, but at least you'll have a chance. That was far better than attacking Sadeus as he crossed. Kaladin's men nodded and Moash seemed content. As contrary as he'd been originally, he had grown equally loyal. He was hot-headed, but he was also the best with the spear. Sadeus approached, riding his roan stallion, wearing his red shard plate, helm on but visor up. By chance, he crossed on Kaladin's bridge, though, as always, he had 20 to choose from. Sadeus didn't give Bridge 4 so much as a glance.
Break and cross, Kaladin ordered after Sadeus was over.
The bridgemen crossed their bridge, and Kaladin gave the orders for them to pull it behind them, then lift. It felt heavier than it ever had before. The bridgemen broke into a trot, rounding the army column and hustling to reach the next chasm. In the distance behind, a second army, one in blue, was following them, crossing using some of Sadeus's other bridge crews. It looked like Dalinar Kholin had given up his bulky mechanical bridges and was now using Sadeus's own bridge crews to cross. So much for his honor and not sacrificing bridgemen lives. In his pouch, Kaladin carried a large number of infused spheres, obtained from the money changers in exchange for a greater quantity of dun spheres. He hated taking that loss, but he needed the stormlight. They reached the next chasm quickly. It would be the next to last one, according to the word he'd gotten from Matal, Ashal's husband. The soldiers began checking their armor, stretching, anticipation spren rising in the air like small streamers. The bridgemen set their bridge and stepped back. Kaladin noted Lopin and Silent Dabid approaching with their stretcher, water skins and bandages inside. Lopin had hitched the stretcher to a hook at his waist, making up for his missing arm. The two moved among the members of Bridge 4, giving them water. As he passed Kaladin, Lopin nodded toward the large bulge at the stretcher's center. The armor.
When do you want it? Lopin asked softly, lowering the litter, then handing Kaladin a water skin.
Right before we run the assault, Kaladin replied.
You did well, Lopin.
Lopin winked.
A one-armed Hardassian is still twice as useful as a no-brained Alethi. Plus, so long as I've got one hand, I can still do this.
He covertly made a rude gesture toward the marching soldiers. Kaladin smiled, but was growing too nervous to feel mirth. It had been a long time since he'd gotten jitters going into a battle. He thought Tux had beaten that out of him years ago.
Hey,
a sudden voice called.
I need some of that.
Kaladin spun to see a soldier walking over. He was exactly the type of man Kaladin had known to avoid back in Amaram's army. Dark-eyed but of modest rank, he was naturally large, and had probably gotten promoted by sheer virtue of size. His armor was well-maintained, but the uniform beneath was stained and wrinkled, and he kept the sleeves rolled up, exposing hairy arms. At first, Kaladin assumed that the man had seen Lopin's gesture, but the man didn't seem mad. He shoved Kaladin aside, then pulled the waterskin away from Lopin. Nearby, the soldiers waiting to cross had noticed. Their own water crews were much slower, and more than a few of the waiting men eyed Lopin and his waterskins. It would set a terrible precedent to let the soldiers take their water, but that was only a tiny problem compared with the greater one. If those soldiers swarmed around the litter to get water, they'd discover the sack full of armor. Kaladin moved quickly, snatching the water skin from the soldier's hand.
You have your own water crews.
The soldier looked at Kaladin, as if completely unable to believe that a bridgeman was standing up to him. He scowled darkly, lowering his spear to his side, its butt against the ground.
I don't want to wait.
How unfortunate, Kaladin said,
stepping right up to the man, meeting him eye to eye. Silently, he cursed the idiot. If it turned into a scuffle. The soldier hesitated,
even more astonished to see such an aggressive threat from a bridgeman. Kaladin wasn't as thick-armed as this man, but he was a finger or two taller. The soldier's uncertainty showed in his face. Just back down, Kaladin thought. But no, backing down from a bridgeman while his squad was watching? The man made a fist, knuckles cracking. Within seconds, the entire bridge crew was there. The soldier blinked as Bridge 4 formed around Kaladin in an aggressive inverted wedge pattern, moving naturally, smoothly, as Kaladin had trained them. Each one made fists, giving the soldier ample chance to see that the heavy lifting had trained these men to a physical level beyond that of the average soldier. The man glanced back at his squad as if looking for support.
"Do you want to spark a fight now, friend?" Kaladin asked softly. "If you hurt the bridgeman, I wonder who Sadeus will make run this bridge."
The man glanced back at Kaladin, was silent for a moment, then scowled, cursed, and stalked away.
"Probably full of crim anyway," he muttered, rejoining his team.
The members of Bridge 4 relaxed, though they received more than a few appreciative looks from the other soldiers in line. For once, there was something other than scowls. Hopefully they wouldn't realize that a squad of bridgemen had quickly and accurately made a battle formation commonly used in spear fighting. Kaladin waved for his men to stand down, nodding his thanks. They fell back, and Kaladin tossed the recovered waterskin back to Lopin. The shorter man smirked wryly.
"I'll keep a tighter grip on these things from now on, Goncho."
He eyed the soldier who had tried to take the water. "What?" Kaladin asked.
"Well, I've got a cousin in the water crews, you see," Lopin said, "and I'm thinking that he might owe me a favor on account of this one time I helped his sister's friend escape a guy looking for her."
"You do have a lot of cousins."
"Never enough. You bother one of us, you bother us all. That's something you strawheads never seem to get. No offense or anything, Goncho."
Kaladin raised an eyebrow.
"Don't make trouble for the soldier. Not today. I'll make enough of that myself here soon."
Lopin sighed, but nodded.
"All right. For you."
He held up a waterskin.
"You sure you don't want any?"
Kaladin didn't. His stomach was too unsettled, but he made himself take the waterskin back and drink a few mouthfuls. Before long, the time came to cross and pull the bridge up for the last run. The assault. Sadeus's soldiers were forming ranks, light eyes riding back and forth, calling orders. Matal waved Kaladin's crew forward. Dalinar Kolin's army had fallen behind, coming more slowly because of his larger numbers. Kaladin took his place at the very front of his bridge. Ahead, the Parshendi were lined up with bows on the edge of their plateau, staring down the oncoming assault. Were they singing already? Kaladin thought he could hear their voices. Moash was on Kaladin's right, Rock on his left. Only three on the death line because of how shorthanded they were. He'd put Shen in the very back so he wouldn't see what Kaladin was about to do.
"I'm going to duck out from underneath once we start moving," Kaladin told them. "Rock, you take over. Keep them running."
"Very well," Rock said. "It will be hard to carry without you. We have so few men, and we are very weak."
"You'll manage. You'll have to."
Kaladin couldn't see Rock's face, not positioned under the bridge as they were, but his voice sounded troubled.
"This thing you will try is dangerous?"
"Perhaps."
"Can I help?"
"I'm afraid not, my friend. But it strengthens me to hear you ask."
Rock didn't get a chance to reply. Matal yelled for the bridge crews to go. Arrows shot overhead to distract the Parshendi. Bridge 4 broke into a run. And Kaladin ducked down and dashed out in front of them. Lopin was waiting to the side, and he tossed Kaladin the sack of armor. Matal screamed at Kaladin in a panic, but the bridge crews were already in motion. Kaladin focused on his goal, protecting Bridge 4, and sucked in sharply. Stormlight flooded him from the pouch at his waist, but he didn't draw too much, just enough to give him a jolt of energy. Sills zipped in front of him, a ripple in the air, nearly invisible.
Kaladin whipped the tie off the sack, pulling out the vest and throwing it awkwardly over his head. He ignored the ties at the side, getting on the helm as he leaped over a small rock formation. The shield came last, clattering with red Parshendi bones in a crisscross pattern on the front. Even while donning the armor, Kaladin easily stayed far ahead of the heavily laden bridge crews. His stormlight-infused legs were quick and sure. The Parshendi archers, directly ahead of him, abruptly stopped singing. Several of them lowered their bows, and though it was too distant to make out their faces, he could sense their outrage. Kaladin had expected this. He'd hoped for it. The Parshendi left their dead. Not because they were uncaring, but because they found it a terrible offense to move them. Merely touching the dead seemed a sin. If that was the case, a man desecrating corpses and wearing them into battle would be far, far worse. As Kaladin grew closer, a different song started among the Parshendi archers. A quick, violent song, more chant than melody. Those who had lowered their bows raised them, and they tried with everything they had to kill him. Arrows flew at him, dozens of them. They weren't fired in careful waves, they flew individually, rapidly, wildly, each archer loosing at Kaladin as quickly as he could. A swarm of death bore down on him. Pulse racing, Kaladin ducked to the left, leaping off a small outcropping. Arrows sliced the air around him, dangerously close. But while infused with the stormlight, his muscles reacted quickly. He dodged between arrows, then turned in the other direction, moving erratically. Behind, Bridge 4 came into range, and not a single arrow was fired at them. Other bridge crews were ignored as well, many of the archers focusing on Kaladin. The arrows came more swiftly, spraying around him, bouncing off his shield. One sliced open his arm as it shot past, another snapped against his helm, nearly knocking it free. The arm wound leaked light, not blood, and to Kaladin's amazement it slowly began to seal up, frost crystallizing on his skin and stormlight draining from him. He drew in more, infusing himself to the cusp of glowing visibility. He ducked, he dodged, he jumped, he ran. His battle-trained reflexes delighted in the newfound speed, and he used the shield to knock arrows out of the air. It was as if his body had longed for this ability, as if it had been born to take advantage of the stormlight. During the earlier part of his life, he had lived sluggish and impotent. Now he was healed, not acting beyond his capacities, no, finally reaching them. A flock of arrows sought his blood, but Kaladin spun between them, taking another slice on the arm but deflecting the others with shield or breastplate. The flight came, and he brought his shield up, worried that he was going to be too slow. However, the arrows changed course, arcing toward his shield, slamming into it, drawn to it. "I'm pulling them to it." He remembered dozens of bridge runs with arrows slamming into the wood near where his hands had clung to the support bars, always just missing him. "How long have I been doing this?" Kaladin thought. "How many arrows did I draw to the bridge, pulling them away from me?" He didn't have time to think about that. He kept moving, dodging. He felt arrows whish through the air, heard them zip, felt the splinters as they hit stone or shield and broke. He'd hoped that he would distract some of the Parshendi from firing on his men, but he'd had no idea how strong a reaction he'd get. Part of him exulted in the thrill of ducking, dodging, and blocking the hail of arrows. He started to slow, however. He tried to suck in stormlight, but none came. His spheres were drained. He panicked, still dodging, but then the arrow falls began to slacken. With a start, Kaladin realized that the bridge crews had parted around him, leaving a space for him to keep dodging while they passed him and set their burdens. Bridge 4 was in place, cavalry charging across to attack the archers. Despite that, some of the Parshendi continued to fire on Kaladin, enraged. The soldiers cut these Parshendi down easily, sweeping the ground of them and making room for Sadius's foot soldiers. Kaladin lowered his shield. It bristled with arrows. He barely had time to take a fresh breath of air as the bridgemen reached him, calling out with joy, nearly tackling him in their excitement.
"You fool," Moash said. "You storming fool. What was that? What were you thinking?"
"Was incredible," Rock said.
"You should be dead,"
Sigsel said, though his normally stern face was split by a smile.
Stormfather,
Moash added, pulling an arrow from Kaladin's vest at the shoulder.
Look at these.
Kaladin looked down, shocked to find a dozen arrow holes in the sides of his vest and shirt where he'd narrowly avoided being hit. Three arrows stuck from the leather.
Storm-blessed, Scar said. That's all there is to it.
Kaladin shrugged off their praise, his heart still pounding. He was numb. Amazed that he'd survived, cold from the stormlight he'd consumed, exhausted as if he'd run a rigorous obstacle course. He looked to Teft, raising an eyebrow, nodding toward the pouch at his waist. Teft shook his head. He'd watched. The stormlight rising from Kaladin hadn't been visible to those observing, not in the light of day. Still, the way Kaladin had dodged would have looked incredible, even without the obvious light. If there had been stories about him before, they would grow greatly following this. He turned to look at the passing troops. As he did, he realized something. He still had to deal with Metal.
Fall into line, men, he said.
They obeyed reluctantly, falling into place around him in a double rank. Ahead, Metal stood beside their bridge. He looked concerned, as well he should. Sadeus was riding up. Kaladin steeled himself, remembering how his previous victory, when they'd run with the bridge on its side, had been turned on its head. He hesitated, then hurried over toward the bridge where Sadeus was going to ride past Metal. Kaladin's men followed. Kaladin arrived as Metal bowed to Sadeus, who wore his glorious red shard plate. Kaladin and the bridgemen bowed as well.
Avarak Metal, Sadeus said.
He nodded toward Kaladin.
This man looks familiar. He is the one from before, Bright Lord,
Metal said, nervous.
The one who... Ah, yes, Sadeus said. The miracle. And you sent him forward as a decoy like that? One would think that you would be hesitant to dare such measures. I take full responsibility, Bright Lord,
Metal said, putting the best face on it. Sadeus regarded the battlefield.
Well, luckily for you, it worked. I suppose I'll have to promote you now.
He shook his head.
Those savages practically ignored the assault force. All 20 bridges set, most with nary a casualty. It seems like a waste somehow. Consider yourself commended. Most remarkable the way that boy dodged.
He kicked his horse into motion, leaving Metal and the bridgemen behind. It was the most backhanded promotion Kaladin had ever heard, but that would do. Kaladin smiled broadly as Metal turned to him, eyes enraged.
You,
Metal sputtered.
You could have gotten me executed.
Instead I got you promoted, Kaladin said, bridge four forming around him.
I should see you strung up anyway.
It's been tried, Kaladin said. Didn't work. Besides, you know that from now on Sadeus is going to expect me to be out there distracting the archers. Good luck getting any other bridgeman to try that. Metal's face grew red. He turned and stalked away to check on the other bridge crews. The two nearest, Bridge 7 and Bridge 18, stood looking toward Kaladin and his team. All 20 bridges had been set? Hardly any casualties? Stormfather, Kaladin thought. How many archers were firing at me?
You did it, Kaladin, Moash exclaimed. You found the secret. We need to make this work. Expand it.
I'll bet I could dodge those arrows if that were all I was doing, Scar said. With enough armor.
We should have more than one, Moash agreed. Five or so running around drawing the Parshendi attacks.
The bones, Rock said, folding his arms. This is what made it work. The Parshendi were so mad that they ignored bridge crew. If all five were the bones of Parshendi.
That made Kaladin consider something. He looked back, searching through the bridgemen. Where was Shen? There. He was sitting on the rocks, distant, staring forward. Kaladin approached with the others. The Parshman looked up at him, face a mask of pain, tears streaking his cheeks. He looked at Kaladin and shuddered visibly, turning away, closing his eyes.
"He sat down like that the moment he saw what you'd done, lad," Teft said, rubbing his chin. "Might not be good for bridge runs anymore."
Kaladin pulled the carapace-tied helm off his head, then ran his fingers through his hair. The carapace stuck to his clothing stank faintly, even though he'd washed it off down below.
"We'll see," Kaladin said, feeling a twist of guilt.
Not nearly enough to overshadow the victory of protecting his men, but enough to dampen it, at least.
"For now, there are still many bridge crews that got fired upon. You know what to do."
The men nodded, trotting off to search for the wounded. Kaladin set one man to watch over Shen, he wasn't sure what else to do with the Parshman, and tried not to show his exhaustion as he put his sweaty, carapace-covered cap and vest in Lopin's litter. He knelt down to go through his medical equipment, in case it was needed, and found that his hand was shaking and quivering. He pressed it down against the ground to still it, breathing in and out.
"Cold, clammy skin," he thought. "Nausea? Weakness?"
He was in shock.
"You all right, lad?"
Teft asked, kneeling down beside Kaladin. He still wore a bandage on his arm from the wound he'd taken a few bridge runs back, but it wasn't enough to stop him from carrying. Not when there were too few as it was.
"I'll be fine," Kaladin said, taking out a water skin, holding it in a quivering hand.
He could barely get the top off.
"You don't look—"
"I'll be fine," Kaladin said again, drinking, then lowering the water. "What's important is that the men are safe."
"You going to do this every time? Whenever we go to battle?"
"Whatever keeps them safe."
"You're not immortal, Kaladin," Teft said softly. "The Radiants, they could be killed just like any man. Sooner or later, one of those arrows will find your neck instead of your shoulder."
"The Stormlight heals."
"The Stormlight helps your body heal. That's different, I'm thinking."
Teft laid a hand on Kaladin's shoulder.
"We can't lose you, lad. The men need you."
"I'm not going to avoid putting myself in danger, Teft, and I'm not going to leave the men to face a storm of arrows if I can do something about it."
"Well," Teft said, "you are going to let a few of us go out there with you. The bridge can manage with 25 if it has to. That leaves us a few extra, just like Rock said. And I'll bet some of those wounded from the other crews we saved are well enough to begin helping carry. They won't dare send them back to their own crews, not so long as Bridge 4 is doing what you did today, and helping the whole assault work."
Kaladin trailed off. He could imagine Dalet doing something like this. He'd always said that as a sergeant, part of his job was to keep Kaladin alive.
"All right."
Teft nodded, rising.
"You were a spearman, Teft," Kaladin said. "Don't try to deny it. How did you end up here, in these bridge crews?" "It's where I belong."
Teft turned away to supervise the search for wounded. Kaladin sat down, then lay back, waiting for the shock to wear off. To the south, the other army, flying the blue of Dalinar Kholin, had arrived. They crossed to an adjacent plateau. Kaladin closed his eyes to recover. Eventually, he heard something and opened his eyes. Syl sat cross-legged on his chest. Behind her, Dalinar Kholin's army had begun an assault onto the battlefield, and they managed to do so without getting fired on. Sadeas had the Parshendi cut off.
"That was amazing," Kaladin said to Syl. "What I did with the arrows."
"Still think you're cursed?"
"No. I know I'm not."
He looked up at the overcast sky. "But that means the failures were all just me. I let Tian die. I failed my spearmen. The slaves I tried to rescue. Terra." He hadn't thought of her in some time. His failure with her had been different from the others, but a failure it was, nonetheless.
"If there's no curse or bad luck, no god above being angry at me, I have to live with knowing that with a little more effort, a little more practice or skill, I could have saved them."
Syl frowned more deeply.
Kaladin, you need to get over this. Those things aren't your fault.
That's what my father used to say. He smiled faintly. Overcome your guilt, Kaladin. Care, but not too much. Take responsibility, but don't blame yourself. Protect, save, help, but know when to give up. They're such precarious ledges to walk. How do I do it?
I don't know. I don't know any of this, Kaladin. But you're ripping yourself apart. Inside and out.
Kaladin stared at the sky above. It was wondrous. I was a storm, Syl. The Parshendi couldn't touch me. The arrows were nothing.
You're too new to this. You pushed yourself too hard.
Save them, Kaladin whispered. Do the impossible, Kaladin. But don't push yourself too hard. But also don't feel guilty if you fail. Precarious ledges, Syl. So narrow. Some of his men returned with a wounded man, a square-faced Thalen fellow with an arrow in the shoulder. Kaladin went to work. His hands were still shaking slightly, but not nearly as badly as they had been. The bridgemen clustered around, watching. He'd started training Rock, Drahi, and Scar already, but with all of them watching, Kaladin found himself explaining. If you put pressure here, you can slow the blood flow. This isn't too dangerous a wound, though it probably doesn't feel too good. The patient grimaced his agreement. And the real problem will come from infection. Wash the wound to make sure there aren't any slivers of wood or bits of metal left, then sew it. The muscles and skin of the shoulder here are going to get worked, so you need a strong thread to hold the wound together. Now,
Kaladin,
Lopin said, sounding worried. What? Kaladin said, distracted, still working.
Kaladin!
Lopin had called him by his name, rather than saying Goncho. Kaladin stood up, turning to see the short Herdazian man standing at the back of the crowd, pointing at the chasm. The battle had moved farther north, but a group of Parshendi had punched through Sadius's line. They had bows. Kaladin watched, stunned, as the group of Parshendi fell into formation and knocked. 50 arrows, all pointed at Kaladin's crew. The Parshendi didn't seem to care that they were exposing themselves to attack from behind. They seemed focused on only one thing, destroying Kaladin and his men. Kaladin screamed the alarm, but he felt so sluggish, so tired. The bridgemen around him turned as the archers drew. Sadius's men normally defended the chasm to keep Parshendi from pushing over the bridges and cutting off their escape. But this time, noticing that the archers weren't trying to drop the bridges, the soldiers didn't hasten to stop them. They left the bridgemen to die, instead cutting off the Parshendi route to the bridges themselves. Kaladin's men were exposed. Perfect targets. No, Kaladin thought.
No, it can't happen like this. Not after...
A force crashed into the Parshendi line. A single figure in slate-gray armor wielding a sword as long as many men were tall. The shardbearer swept through the distracted archers with urgency, slicing into their ranks. Arrows flew toward Kaladin's team, but they were loosed too early, aimed poorly. A few came close as the bridgemen ducked for cover, but nobody was hit. Parshendi fell before the sweeping blade of the shardbearer, some toppling into the chasm, others scrambling back. The rest died with burned-out eyes. In seconds, the squad of 50 archers had been reduced to corpses. The shardbearer's honor guard caught up with him. He turned, armor seeming to glow as he raised his blade in a salute of respect toward the bridgemen. Then he charged off in another direction.
That was him, Drahi said, standing up. Dalinar Kholin, the king's uncle. He saved us, Lopin said.
Bah, Moash dusted himself off. He just saw a group of undefended archers and took the chance to strike. Light Eyes don't care about us. Right, Kaladin?
Kaladin stared at the place where the archers had stood. In one moment, he could have lost it all.
Kaladin? Moash said.
You're right, Kaladin found himself saying. Just an opportunity taken. Except why raise the blade toward Kaladin? From now on, Kaladin said, we pull back farther after the soldiers cross. They used to ignore us after the battle began, but they won't any longer. What I did today, what we're all going to be doing soon, will make them mighty angry. Angry enough to be stupid, but also angry enough to see us dead. For now, Leighton, Narm, find good scouting points and watch the field. I want to know if any Parshendi make moves toward that chasm. I'll get this man bandaged, and we'll pull back. The two scouts ran off, and Kaladin turned back to the man with the wounded shoulder. Moash knelt beside him. An assault against a prepared for without any bridges lost? A shard-bearer coincidentally coming to our rescue? Sadeus himself complimenting us. You almost make me think I should get one of those armbands. Kaladin glanced down at the prayer. It was stained with blood from a slice on his arm that the vanishing stormlight hadn't quite been able to heal. Wait to see if we escape. Kaladin finished the stitching. That's the real test. Fear.
I wish to sleep. I know now why you do what you do, and I hate you for it. I will not speak of the truths I see.
Kakasha, 1173, 142 seconds pre-death. A Shin sailor, left behind by his crew, reportedly for bringing them ill luck. Sample largely useless.
You see?
Leighton turned the piece of carapace over in his hands.
If we carve it up at the edge, it encourages a blade, or in this case an arrow, to deflect away from the face. Wouldn't want to spoil that pretty grin of yours.
Kaladin smiled, taking back the piece of armor. Leighton had carved it expertly, putting in holes for leather straps to affix it to the jerkin. The chasm was cold and dark at night. With the sky hidden, it felt like a cavern. Only the occasional sparkle of a star high above revealed otherwise.
How soon can you have them done? He asked Leighton.
All five? By the end of the night, likely? The real trick was discovering how to work it.
He knocked on the carapace with the back of his knuckles.
Amazing stuff. Nearly as hard as steel, but half the weight. Hard to cut or break. But if you drill, it shapes easily.
Good, Kaladin said. Because I don't want five sets. I want one for each man in the crew. Leighton raised an eyebrow. If they're going to start letting us wear armor, Kaladin said, everyone gets a suit. Except Shen, of course. Metall had agreed to let them leave him behind on the bridge runs. He wouldn't even look at Kaladin now. Leighton nodded.
All right, then. Better get me some help, though.
You can use the wounded men. We'll cart out as much carapace as we can find.
His success had translated to an easier time for Bridge 4. Kaladin had pled that his men needed time to find carapace, and Hashal, not knowing any better, had reduced the scavenging quota. She was already pretending, quite smoothly, that the armor had been her idea the entire time. When she met Kaladin's eyes, however, he saw worry. What else would he try? So far, she hadn't dared remove him, not while he brought her so much praise from Sadeus.
How did an apprentice armorer end up as a bridgeman, anyway? Kaladin asked as Leighton settled back down to work.
He was a thick-armed man, stout and oval-faced with light hair. Craftsmen don't usually get thrown away. Leighton shrugged.
When a piece of armor breaks and a light eyes takes an arrow in the shoulder, someone has to take the blame. I'm convinced my master keeps an extra apprentice, especially for those kinds of situation.
Well, his loss is our good fortune. You're going to keep us alive.
I'll do my best, sir.
He smiled.
Can't do much worse on the armor than you did yourself, though. It's amazing that breastplate didn't fall off halfway through.
Kaladin patted the bridgeman on the shoulder, then left him to his work, surrounded by a small ring of topaz chips. Kaladin had gotten permission to bring them, explaining his men needed light to work on the armor. Nearby, Lopin, Rock, and Dabbid were returning with another load of salvage. Syl zipped ahead, leading them. Kaladin walked down the chasm, a garnet sphere looped in a small leather carrier at his belt for light. The chasm branched here, making a large triangular intersection, a perfect place for spear training. Wide enough to give the men room to practice, yet far enough from any permanent bridges that scouts weren't likely to hear echoes. Kaladin gave the initial instructions each day, then let Teft lead the practice. The men worked by sphere light, small piles of diamond chips at the corners of the intersection, barely enough to see by. Never thought I'd envy those days practicing beneath the hot sun back in Amaram's army, he thought. He walked up to Gap-toothed Hobber and corrected his stance, then showed him how to set his weight behind his spear thrusts. The bridgemen were progressing quickly, and the fundamentals were proving their merit. Some were training with the spear and the shield, practicing stances where they held lighter spears up beside the head with the shield raised. The most skilled were Scar and Moash. In fact, Moash was surprisingly good. Kaladin walked to the side, watching the hawk-faced man. He was focused, eyes intense, jaw set. He moved in attack after attack, the dozen spheres giving him an equal number of shadows. Kaladin remembered feeling such dedication. He'd spent a year like that after Tian's death, driving himself to exhaustion each day, determined to get better, determined never to let another person die because of his lack of skill. He'd become the best in his squad, then the best in his company. Some said he'd been the best spearman in Amaram's army. What would have happened to him if Terra hadn't coaxed him out of his single-minded dedication? Would he have burned himself out, as she'd claimed? Moash, Kaladin called. Moash paused, turning toward Kaladin. He didn't fall out of stance. Kaladin waved him to approach, and Moash reluctantly trotted over. Lopin had left a few water skins for them, hanging by their cords from a cluster of haspers. Kaladin pulled a skin free, tossing it to Moash. The other man took a drink, then wiped his mouth. You're getting good, Kaladin said. You're probably the best we have. Thanks, Moash said. I've noticed you keep training when Teft lets the other men take breaks. Dedication is good, but don't work yourself ragged. I want you to be one of the decoys. Moash smiled broadly. Each of the men had volunteered to be one of the four who would join Kaladin distracting the Parshendi. It was amazing. Months ago, Moash, along with the others, had eagerly placed the new or the weak at the front of the bridge to catch arrows. Now, to a man, they volunteered for the most dangerous jobs. Do you realize what you could have in these men, Sadeus? Kaladin thought. If you weren't so busy thinking of how to get them killed? So what is it for you? Kaladin said, nodding toward the dim practice ground. Why do you work so hard? What is it you hunt? Vengeance, the other man said, face somber. Kaladin nodded. I lost someone once, because I wasn't good enough with the spear. I nearly killed myself practicing. Who was it? My brother. Moash nodded. The other bridgemen, Moash included, seemed to regard Kaladin's mysterious past with reverence. I'm glad I trained, Kaladin said, and I'm glad you're dedicated. But you have to be careful. If I'd gotten myself killed by working so hard, it wouldn't have meant anything. Sure, but there's a difference between us, Kaladin. Kaladin raised an eyebrow. You wanted to be able to save someone. Me? I want to kill somebody. Who? Moash hesitated, then shook his head. Maybe I'll say someday. He reached out, grabbing Kaladin on the shoulder. I'd surrendered my plans, but you've returned them to me. I'll guard you with my life, Kaladin. I swear it to you, by the blood of my fathers. Kaladin met Moash's intense eyes and nodded. All right, then. Go help Hobber and Yake. They're still off on their thrusts. Moash jogged off to do as told. He didn't call Kaladin sir and didn't seem to regard him with the same unspoken reverence as the others. That made Kaladin more comfortable with him. Kaladin spent the next hour helping the men one by one. Most of them were overeager, throwing themselves into their attacks. Kaladin explained the importance of control and precision, which won more fights than chaotic enthusiasm. They took it in, listening. More and more they reminded him of his old spear squad. That set him thinking. He remembered how he had felt when originally proposing the escape plan to the men. He'd been looking for something to do, a way to fight, no matter how risky, a chance. Things had changed. He now had a team he was proud of, friends he had come to love, and a possibility, perhaps, for stability. If they could get the dodging and armor right, they might be reasonably safe, maybe even as safe as his old spear squad had been. Was running still the best option?
That is a worried face, a rumbling voice noted.
Kaladin turned as Rock walked up and leaned against the wall near him, folding powerful forearms.
Is the face of a leader, say I. Always troubled.
Rock raised a bushy red eyebrow.
Sadeas will never let us go, particularly not now that we're so prominent.
Alethi Lighteyes considered it reprehensible for a man to let slaves escape. It made him seem impotent. Capturing those who ran away was essential to save face.
You said this thing before, Rock said. We will fight the men he sends after us. We'll seek Garbranth, where there are no slaves. From there, the peaks, to my people who will welcome us as heroes.
We might beat the first group, if he's foolish and sends only a few dozen men. But after that he'll send more. And what of our wounded? Do we leave them here to die? Or do we take them with us and go that much more slowly?
Rock nodded slowly.
You are saying that we need a plan.
Yes, Kaladin said. I guess that's what I'm saying. Either that or we stay here, as bridgemen.
Ha!
Rock seemed to take it as a joke.
Despite new armor, we would die soon. We make ourselves targets.
Kaladin hesitated. Rock was right. The bridgemen would be used day in and day out. Even if Kaladin slowed the death toll to 2 or 3 men a month, once he would have considered that impossible, but now it seemed within reach. Bridge 4, as it was currently composed, would be gone within a year.
I will talk with Sigzil about this thing, Rock said,
rubbing his chin between the sides of his beard.
We will think. There must be a way to escape this trap, a way to disappear. A false trail, a distraction. Perhaps we can convince Sadeas that we have died during Bridge Run.
How do we do that?
Don't know, Rock said. But we will think.
He nodded to Kaladin and sauntered off toward Sigzil. The Azish man was practicing with the others. Kaladin had tried speaking to him about Hoid, but Sigzil, typically close-mouthed, hadn't wanted to discuss it.
Hey, Kaladin,
Scar called. He was part of an advanced group that was going through Teft's very carefully supervised sparring.
Come spar with us. Show these rock-brained fools how it's really done.
The others began calling for him as well. Kaladin waved them down, shaking his head. Teft trotted over, a heavy spear on one shoulder.
Lad, he said quietly, I think it would be good for their morale if you showed them a thing or two yourself.
I've already given them instruction.
With a spear you knock the head off of. Going very slowly, with lots of talk. They need to see it, lad. See you.
We've been through this, Teft.
Well, so we have.
Kaladin smiled. Teft was careful not to look angry or belligerent. He looked as if he were having a normal conversation with Kaladin.
You've been a sergeant before, haven't you?
Never mind that. Come on, just show them a few simple routines.
No, Teft,
Kaladin said more seriously. Teft eyed him.
You going to refuse to fight on the battlefield, just like that horn eater?
It's not like that.
Well, what is it like?
Kaladin reached for an explanation. I'll fight when the time comes. But if I let myself get back into it now, I'll be too eager. I'll push to attack now. I'll have trouble waiting until the men are ready. Trust me, Teft. Teft studied him.
You're scared of it, lad.
What? No, I...
I can see it, Teft said. And I've seen it before. Last time you fought for someone you failed, eh? So now you hesitate to take it up again.
Kaladin paused. Yes, he admitted. But it was more than that. When he fought again, he would have to become that man from long ago. The man who had been called Stormblessed. The man with confidence and strength. He wasn't certain he could be that man any longer. That was what scared him. Once he held that spear again, there would be no turning back.
Well,
Teft rubbed his chin.
When the time comes, I hope you're ready. Because this lot will need you.
Kaladin nodded, and Teft hurried back to the others, giving some kind of explanation to mollify them.